Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. Many of us have a love-hate relationship with digital technologies, social media, smart speakers, and on and on. We love the convenience, but we fear the loss of privacy and wonder what our tech is doing to our brains. Well, my next guest says it may actually be more nefarious than you even suspect, that the technologies we're inventing are actually grooming us to be more subservient users. Brett Frischman is the Charles Widger Endowed University Professor in Law, Business, and Economics at Villanova University. His latest book out on Cambridge University Press is Reengineering Humanity. Brett, thanks for coming in.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about this scary idea that our technologies are in some way changing us. I mean, I think we know that some of our behaviors have changed, but you say that we're engineering technologies that are now kind of engineering us. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So we always engineer ourselves through the technologies we use. So it's not necessarily that it's a completely new phenomena. So from our earliest time, for millennia, humans have developed tools. And as they've used technologies and tools and developed social institutions, they've kind of re-engineered themselves, changing what they can do, what they spend their time doing, and the skills they develop and practice.
But then how is this different? I mean, if we take an example, even a relatively modern one, like the car, which obviously we've become completely dependent on and did pretty quickly and completely changed not only our individual behaviors, but the way our society is built and functions. How is this new internet technology any different than that? And why should we be any more worried about it, I guess?
Well, so the technology, the digital networked technologies that are becoming everyday parts of most of our lives influence and shape who we are as people in a much more personal way. It's more connected to our thoughts, how we think, how we interact with each other. It's also much more personalized, but also at the same time ubiquitous. So it's in some sense the technologies are everywhere and becoming embedded in everything, ranging from your homes to your the clothes you wear to the things you do. You know, you're carrying your smartphone with you constantly. It's a difference in sort of degree in the sense that there's more and more of the technology having impacts on very sort of small and subtle things that we do.
Most of us don't sleep with our cars.
Right. That's exactly right. So we've often used calendars. It's not like calendars are new, but that reliance on instant notification, that, you know, the vibration in your pocket to give you your next instruction or to remind you about what you're to do next. It's a little bit more intense and personal.
There's a growing amount of concern about clinical addiction to some of these technologies. And I think a lot of us recognize some degree of some of those symptoms in our own lives. But to think that whether it's social media or, you know, even just a calendar that reminds you of things, to think that these technologies have been designed specifically to create that addiction, that's a level of almost malicious action that I don't think most of us have thought about, right? Like we think, oh, well, this has been a side effect of how we've started to use these. But you're actually saying, no, that's built in. That's baked in. That was the intention.
In our book, in Reengineering Humanity, we talk about sort of the addictive quality of some of the technologies. But we also suggest that it's not just about addiction. So the idea that you have a behavioral dependence, like so some of your behaviors, you're sort of reliant on the technology so intimately, and you're reliant on a certain kind of, you know, some people talk about it in terms of a dopamine rush that's supplied to you through certain kinds of technologies. And so addiction's a part of the problem, but it doesn't fully capture the whole problem.
So right. What is the larger problem?
Right. So it's almost, I sometimes, in the book, we talk about it this way. If you think about a couple months ago, there was a Cambridge Analytica debacle, right? Blows up and everyone's, oh my, there's this app that's been run, that people were running on Facebook and grabbing, stealing, capturing the Facebook user data and then using it to nudge them to behave in certain ways, whether it's in, you know, how to vote or what to do, right? Sort of Cambridge Analytica is grabbing the data and then using it in a sense, against the Facebook users, against the people, right? That may lead one to think we just have to deal with Cambridge Analytica. But of course, there's dozens, maybe hundreds of similarly situated companies just like Cambridge Analytica collecting data of different kinds off of Facebook. And then so you might jump and say, well, it's a Facebook problem, right? We have to figure out how to regulate and govern Facebook, or we need to get rid of Facebook, or just delete Facebook, as some people are saying. The problem is that it's not just Facebook. There are lots of applications layer services that we rely on, whether it's Google for search, Facebook for social networking, Amazon for a whole host of things. Other platforms that have similar business models that are collecting lots of data, surveilling what users do, and servicing not only a set of users, consumers, but also advertisers and other third parties that most consumers don't pay attention to or know about. So then you might think, okay, so the problem is really, it's all of these platforms. It's an internet problem, and there's all these platforms that we need to govern and figure out how to solve that problem. But then you broaden your scope a little bit. We're deploying Fitbits in elementary schools to instruct them better on how to be fit or come up with a fitness plan.
So, there's kind of two parts to what I'm hearing from you. One is there's a problem when we start letting technology do what we've used our own brains for in the past, right? Maybe we're somehow making ourselves dumber, or we're abdicating some control when we let, a Fitbit decide if we've walked enough that day, or we let a calendar decide that it's time for us to do whatever. But then on the other side of that is this issue of data privacy and whether or not organizations, that we don't even necessarily know exist are doing something with our data. Those seem like two really separate problems. Are they separate?
I think they're separate parts of a problem. The data privacy issues, like what people are doing with our data, matters in part because the value from data collection is it's the data is just an input into something else. It's an input into a system for generating intelligence of some sort, one form or another. And that intelligence is used whether to market things and personalize advertising, to improve advertising that'll come back to the user, or it's to personalize some other kind of service for a user. And so I think they end up being connected because the...
So maybe like using your Fitbit and checking your steps and then getting some ad targeted to you about... fitness or health, that whole thing wouldn't be nearly as effective or addictive if there weren't some system in the background that had data about you to say, hey, this person's really interested in getting more fit and we should be targeting those fitness ads. Is that kind of feeding back on itself?
It can. Advertising can be part of it, right? But even in the absence of advertising, let's assume we've got Fitbits in schools, to help kids become more active because we think if they're monitored and surveilled, you can get data and you can use the data to have a better fitness plan for them. Or you could learn about how fit they are or are not and then try to nudge them or encourage them somehow. You don't need advertising involved for that to still be troublesome, to be still concerned about, using Fitbits in schools is about, one of the consequences that often goes unnoticed is you're basically teaching kids or conditioning kids or engineering kids to accept bodily surveillance by the school. And the idea that there are maybe other ways to deal, alternative tools for encouraging fitness besides self-tracking devices doesn't get examined. And so in the book, we talk about how to examine that. What are some of the trade-offs and what are some of the other tools you might think about using? Even paper and pen, you can have an exercise. I'm not saying it's the best, but there are at least alternatives to consider before you jump on the let's just collect data and surveil them.
So right? What are some of those questions that you feel like we should all be asking ourselves a little bit more frequently before or as we engage with all of the technologies that are in our lives? Because I'm assuming you're not just saying we should all just go smash our phones, our computers, all of these technologies and just trash it. But we need to rethink how we engage with it.
Right. I'll start at the individual level, although I think what we need to be, we, It could be you and I as individuals or as parents or as, you know, people, as adults deciding what to do for ourselves. We can also be collectively, in terms of government or markets or, you know, some other broader system. And I think we need to actually think about these, ask questions at both of those levels, both at the micro individual level and at sort of more macro level collectively. But as individuals, it's funny, I'm working on a piece that sort of spins off of the book, which is called Leaving Room for Luddites. And the idea in the piece is that, well, first, someone sort of called me a Luddite and they meant it as a bad thing. And I said, well, that's...
And you took it as a compliment.
I took it as a compliment. And I tried to explain, look, there's a misunderstood way of thinking about Luddites, which is it's just break the technology, you know, anti-tech. And I said, look, I have digital tech cred. I like digital tech. I use digital tech. Being a Luddite is often the way in which we give ourselves time to reflect on our relationship with technology, how technologies that we're currently using and what we, you know, what the next disruptive one might be, how we relate to it, how it affects what we're doing, who we are, how we think, how we act, how we behave with each other, how we socialize. We need to leave some room for Luddism in our lives, which means we need to think about being off sometimes. Only when you're off can you reflect upon what it's like to be off as well as what it's like to be on. If you're always on, right? If you're always connected and waiting, you know, and sort of tuned in to whatever the tech is, whether we're talking about your smartphone or we're talking about, you know, waiting for your notification from your social network.
I mean, the more you say, the more frightening it sounds. And quite frankly, the more overwhelming the problem sounds. And you do, in the book, lay out some pretty frightening worst case scenarios of where we could be headed that sound, quite frankly, like science fiction mind control, you know, the robots are taking over kind of things.
Let me pause you there for a second, if you don't mind. Just because there's a nice little point of contrast. So many people worry about the robots taking over, right? Sentient robots are going to get really, really intelligent. The AI is going to get so smart that it's going to enslave us or take over. Our book is about the exact opposite. It's not about intelligent machines taking over. So I don't really care about the engineering of artificial intelligence or really intelligent machines. I'm more concerned about the engineering of unintelligent humans.
So how do we avoid that? Because you also present that as not a foregone, inevitable conclusion to this whole thing.
Yes. I cannot hammer home as hard enough. Nothing is inevitable other than entropy. So we should not assume that ubiquitous sensors in every room of our house and every building we go in and every street we are on is inevitable. It's just going to happen. The Internet of Things, as is sold and marketed for venture capital and in the business community, is this inevitable. We're just going down this path. Get ready. Here it comes. Let's get really excited about it. I want to just hammer. It's not inevitable. There's nothing inevitable about that. We can design and deploy technology differently. We can engineer systems differently. And I mean engineer both technically, but also socially, right? We can have legal institutions and governance of those systems that are different. You know, for example, I'll give a good example of something that people often say is inevitable, that, you know, I have a 17-year-old, an 11-year-old, and a 9-year-old. My 17-year-old tells me all the time, the 11-year-old who's, he's in sixth grade. Oh, he's going to have a phone. He's going to need a smartphone to function in middle school. It's just going to happen. Like, he's going to have a smartphone. In his mind, my son's mind, it's inevitable. Like, there's no escaping it, Dad. And before long, it's going to be in the, and he's like, that's just now. In a few years, everyone in elementary school, the kids will all have to have it just to participate. That's how they'll interact with Schoology or whatever the program is that they're using at the time. And I start pulling my hair out inside my head and said, it's not inevitable. Like, no, we do not have to deploy all of this tech in the schools just because the tech companies are advertising it as shiny and bright. And, you know, it's the path to personalized learning. And they're going to have to know the tech if they're going to survive in a modern society. That doesn't mean that introducing, you know, laptops and Chromebooks and smartphones and activity, you know, Fitbits and whatever into our middle schools and elementary schools is inevitable. These are choices that, you know, communities need to engage with, and they can make those choices. They could decide that. But the inevitability thing comes up all the time. Everyone thinks we're on a path, and the it's sort of this technological determinist path that the technology is just going to flow in a certain direction. Now, we do paint a picture in the book about a slippery sloped path that we're on, which is a path to ubiquitous, supposedly smart systems that are managing more and more, micromanaging more and more of our lives, who we are, who we can be. We paint that path, that picture, not because it's inevitable, but to say, like, we are on a path now, and many of the steps along the way are recognizable to most of us. You can see different endpoints in terms of where we're headed, but the most important thing is to start envisioning other paths, like other ways we could, the other world we can build. I mean, it seems very science fiction-y to talk about world building in that way, but that's exactly what we're doing. We are all participating in a project of building a world for our children, our grandchildren, and for future generations. And so we have to think very carefully about what's the world we want to build. How do we want to build it? Because nothing's inevitable other than entropy.
That's Brett Frischman. Brett, thanks so much for coming in.
It's been my pleasure.
And that's our show. Until next week, I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.